content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 6, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is set on the front steps of the Capitol building. House Speaker Mike Johnson is holding an old-fashioned round bomb. It's got a fuse coming out of it. The fuse is lit and it's winding down. The bomb itself is covered with $100 bills, and he's in the process of handing it to a startled-looking Senate Majority Leader John Thune. The headline is "Primed to Explode: The House Hands the Senate a Big, Beautiful Debt Bomb." That is our first main story, and we'll start with that. Trump's agenda-defining bill heads to Senate. What happened? President Trump's big, beautiful bill faced an uncertain path in the Senate this week, as some senators vowed to oppose the version that squeaked through the House, and Trump said he expected them to make fairly significant changes. House Speaker Mike Johnson won passage of the bill by a single vote after days of wrangling with both moderates who balked at benefits cuts and fiscal hawks who demanded steeper reductions. The House bill makes permanently the 2017 tax cuts passed under Trump, which were set to expire, and spends $150 billion on border enforcement. It also cuts food stamps by $268 billion and chops some $700 billion from Medicaid, largely by imposing work requirements. Johnson likened getting it through his fractious caucus to crossing over the Grand Canyon on a piece of dental floss, and urged the Senate to make as few modifications as possible. Some senators made it clear they had other plans, with the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimating the bill would add $3.8 trillion over a decade to the $36 trillion national debt. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, vowed to hold out for significant spending cuts. Somebody's got to be the dad that says, "I know y'all want to go to Disney World, but we can't afford it," he said. Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, refused to accept the bill's hike in the debt limit, while several moderates balked at the Medicaid cuts that the CBO predicts will strip health insurance from 7.6 million Americans. With all Democrats opposed, Majority Leader John Thune can lose only three GOP votes, and anything the Senate passes has to be able to clear the divided House. "We're a long ways from the finish line," said Senator Mike Rounds, Republican from South Dakota. What the editorial said: Trump's bill is big, all right, but it's as ugly and malodorous as a heap of garbage under a broiling sun, said the South Florida Sun Sentinel. In addition to stripping millions of their health insurance, it would pull food stamps from 3 million poor people, all to make the rich wealthier. By extending tax cuts that overwhelmingly favor the top 10%. And it adds trillions to our already staggering debt. When senators return from break, they should do what's right for the country and rewrite the monstrosity. The Medicaid cuts have drawn predictable wails from Democrats of the New York Post, but in truth, they don't go nearly far enough. Outlays have skyrocketed, going from $160 billion in 2003 to $591 billion in 2023, as Democrats expanded Medicaid to cover not just the poor, but also the near poor and even the not really poor at all, insisting that able-bodied Americans' work is to receive public charity is the least of the needed fixes. What the columnist said: Republicans aren't really targeting Medicaid fraud, said Pamela Hurd and Donald P. Moynihan in the New York Times. 92% of recipients are already working, disabled, or have another qualifying exemption, such as caregiving. The real goal of the work requirement is to drive off millions of legitimate beneficiaries by overwhelming them with pointless paperwork and other bureaucratic hurdles. It's a sneaky way to dodge political fallout while slashing a program favored by most Americans, including the Republicans' own voters. So much for Trump the reformer, said Charles C.W. Cook in National Review. He was supposed to be the fearless corrective for lily-livered establishment Republicans who always promised to cut spending, reform welfare, and balance the budget, then inevitably failed to follow through. So what does he deliver? A bill that guarantees that deficits will grow and our already spiraling national debt will continue to mount indefinitely. The Trump-led GOP has behaved in precisely the same manner as did the old guard that it claims to disdain. Don't kid yourself that the Senate will save us, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. This bill is the centerpiece of Trump's agenda, and members of his party aren't going to snuff it at the finish line. And that's too bad because it's garbage from tip to tail. Serving up incoherent policies like cutting taxes on tips, it explodes the debt while making no pretense of trying to grapple seriously with America's problems. Handed full control of the White House and Congress, the GOP has barfed up a bill that makes sense only as a sort of formal surrender of America's status as a serious country. Controversy of the week. Anti-Semitism. What a young couple's murder tells us. Yaron Lachinsky and Sarah Milgram were young and in love, said Gil Preuss in Hearts. Lachinsky, 30, had just bought Milgram, 26, an engagement ring and planned to propose next week. But there will be no proposal and no wedding. Last week, as the idealistic young couple left a peace event at the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C., where both worked at the Israeli embassy, they were murdered by Elias Rodriguez, 31, who first shot them in the back, then calmly reloaded and finished Milgram off as she tried to crawl away. "I did it for Gaza," Rodriguez told police. He clearly assumed his victims were Jews, making this a textbook case of anti-Semitic terrorism. Lachinsky was born to a Jewish father and Christian mother and was both a practicing Christian and an Israeli citizen. The violent hatred didn't come out of the blue. Anti-Semitic incidents have surged 893% over the past decade, says the Anti-Defamation League, and the wave has been supercharged by Hamas' October 7th massacre of Israelis and Israel's military response. Rodriguez undoubtedly sees himself as a hero to the Palestinian cause, not as a mere anti-Semite, said Emma Green in The New Yorker. But by slaughtering two people whose lives he knew nothing about, he followed the ugly and ancient logic of anti-Semitism, which holds every Jew anywhere personally responsible for all the ills of the world. Jew hatred has a long and bloody history, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. But this feels like something new. Rodriguez is from Chicago, not Gaza or the West Bank. He is not Palestinian or even Muslim, and his social media accounts reveal an almost frighteningly generic range of young progressive activist views. Rodriguez applauded Luigi Mangione, the alleged murderer of a United Healthcare CEO, and like Mangione, was driven not by mental illness or personal grievance, but by progressive empathy to a cause and the online left's maximalist rhetoric of panic, siege, and destruction. Make no mistake, the progressive ecosystem is breeding killers. And the right-wing ecosystem isn't? Asked Carlo J.V. Caro in the New York Daily News. After a gunman murdered 11 worshipers at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018, the killer's online history revealed a slew of ranting posts on Gab, an early MAGA platform about Jews' involvement in the great replacement of white Americans with immigrants. Many of the alienated young men who voted for President Trump are followers of far-right anti-Semitic influencers such as Andrew Tate, Tucker Carlson, and Nick Fuentes, said Zachary Pazu in Axios. Holocaust denial and racist tropes about Jewish influence are now standard fare on the MAGA-friendly podcast and platforms that helped get Trump elected, including Joe Rogan's. The hatred of Jews is no longer a fringe opinion in this country, said Raihan Salam and Jesse Arm in The Atlantic. We can't criminalize hateful speech, but we can draw a clear line against political violence and its glorification. We must use our legal system and our voices to affirm the principle that no political grievance justifies murder, whether it emanates from the fever swamps on the left or right, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Politically motivated violence in America cannot be tolerated. Only by punishing such atrocities to the fullest extent of the law and making them counterproductive to the causes they seek to advance can we keep them from becoming contagious. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for the Arizona Cardinals, whose home State Farm Stadium in Glendale was ranked first out of all 30 NFL stadiums as a place to ride out a zombie apocalypse. A betting site's tongue-in-cheek report gave State Farm high marks for its closable roof, limited entry points, and natural grass field that is capable of growing crops. It's a good week for precocity. After 11-year-old Alyssa Perales graduated from a community college in California with associate degrees in math and multiple sciences. Homeschooled by her father from the age of one, Alyssa obviously had some innate spark, said Dad Rafael Perales. But she has put in the work. She's moving on to the University of California, Irvine. And it was a good week for wisdom born of experience. After President Trump advised the graduating class at West Point to avoid trophy wives, the thrice-married commander-in-chief, whose third wife spends a little time with him, warned cadets that seeking glamorous young replacements doesn't work out too well. I must tell you, a lot of trophy wives, it doesn't work. But it was a bad week for concentration. After a Microsoft study found that, on average, modern office workers are interrupted by emails, meetings, and assorted other pings every 2 minutes. It's a bad week for FUBAR regulations. After an Army unit in Missouri responsible for accepting new recruits imposed a strict no-cussing policy in response to complaints of extreme profanity, the new policy bans all profanity, vulgar language, rude gestures, or remarks. Finally, it was a bad week for Emmanuel Macron. After a TV video showed the French president being shoved hard in the face by wife Bridget as they prepared to get off a plane in Vietnam, Macron later admitted the couple was bickering, but said the face shove was not a global catastrophe. And a short in other news piece. High Court expands Trump's power to fire agency heads. The Supreme Court ruled last week in favor of an emergency request from President Trump to fire commissioners on the National Labor Relations Board. The court's 6-3 conservative majority ruled that limiting the president's right to fire independent agency heads infringes on his constitutional powers. In a dissent, the three liberal justices said the order lets the president overrule a 90-year-old precedent by fiat. Trump moved earlier this year to fire President Biden's appointees to the NLRB, as well as the Merit Systems Protection Board, which protects federal employees, earlier this year. The ruling lets the president go ahead with dismissals as litigation continues, and it is likely to apply to other agencies, such as the Federal Trade Commission. However, the justices noted that the ruling did not apply to the Federal Reserve, an unusual statement that may reassure financial markets. Briefing this week, flying into danger. America's air traffic control system is in crisis. Can it be fixed? What's wrong with the system? For starters, there's an acute shortage of air traffic controllers who are responsible for directing about 45,000 flights, carrying 2.9 million passengers every day. The Federal Aviation Administration has about 13,800 certified controllers at more than 300 facilities, which is 3,000 below the recommended staffing number. With 90% of control towers understaffed, controllers are routinely expected to put in 10-hour days, 6 days a week. And those controllers have to rely on what the FAA itself describes as outdated technologies that are unable to meet modern demands. Partly because of those cascading problems, 2023 saw 19 serious runway incursions at U.S. airports where a collision was narrowly avoided, the highest number in nearly a decade. Public concern over air traffic control swelled in January after 67 people died in a mid-air crash between a military helicopter and a commercial flight over Washington, D.C. A preliminary FAA report said staffing at the control tower was abnormally low for the shift, and concern surged again in April when controllers for New Jersey's Newark Liberty International Airport lost communication with planes for about 90 seconds due to a single burned-out copper wire. The next month, an air traffic control facility in Colorado suffered a similar outage. "It's a crisis, and the public doesn't know about it," said one Newark controller. "Nobody wants to pay attention until lives are lost." Why is there a staffing shortage? Air traffic control is a historically understaffed profession, and the pandemic only made things worse. When COVID hit and air travel slowed, the training of new recruits was put on hold, even as many older controllers opted for retirement. These experienced workers can't quickly be replaced. To be considered for an air traffic control spot, candidates must be under 31, have U.S. citizenship, and pass a background check, skills assessment, and medical exam. Only about 10% of applicants to the FAA Academy in Oklahoma City are accepted. The Academy has capacity for 2,500 students, but this year received only 1,950, and only about two-thirds of those complete the training program. "It's a lot of work," said one student. "It's like a full 2-year degree in 4 months." After graduating, another 2 to 3 years of classroom and on-the-job experience is required to become a certified controller. The career lifespan of a controller is limited because the profession has a mandatory retirement age of 56. Many quit before then, despite earning six-figure salaries. Why is turnover high? Because it's a stressful job that controllers are expected to do in often less than ideal conditions. In recent years, controllers have submitted hundreds of complaints about rundown facilities with bug and mold infestations, dangerous staffing shortages, and unstable colleagues. Between 2021 and 2023, the FAA received at least 7 reports of controllers sleeping on duty and 5 of people working while under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Some controllers develop physical and or mental health problems because of nonstop schedules, but avoid seeking professional help lest it cost them their medical clearance. The result is a demoralized, distracted, and exhausted workforce that is more prone to making mistakes. A database of air safety issues maintained by NASA includes numerous accounts of mistakes by weary controllers, including one from a staffer in Southern California who instructed a plane to fly too low and attributed the error to being extremely tired after continuous overtime. What about technology issues? Much of the equipment in control towers is decades old and analog, while other countries use digital displays and infrared-based systems. American air traffic controllers are trained to use floppy disks, paper flight tracking strips, and World War II-era radars. Nick Daniels, president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, told a March congressional hearing that the FAA has failed to request adequate funding for infrastructure needs for two decades. The agency's annual $3 billion budget for facilities and equipment, he said, has forced it to adapt a fix-on-fail model that leaves little to no money for modernization. Is anyone trying to repair the system? The Trump administration has promised to supercharge the hiring of controllers who have been spared the cuts inflicted on other government workers. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy recently announced a $5,000 bonus for FAA Academy graduates, with an additional $10,000 for those willing to work at one of the 13 facilities deemed hard to staff, as well as annual 20% bonuses for controllers who stay on past the retirement eligibility mark at 25 years. Duffy has also unveiled plans to replace 618 old radars and build six new air traffic control centers, the largest such project since the 1960s. The tax bill currently working its way through Congress includes $12.5 billion for modernization over the next 3 years. But the Modern Skies Coalition, an organization that includes unions, aircraft manufacturers, and trade groups, says an extra $18.5 billion in emergency funding is needed. Is it still safe to fly? Air travel remains by far the safest mode of transportation. The crash over Washington attracted so much attention in part because of the rarity of such accidents in the U.S. It was the first fatal American commercial air disaster since 2009 and the worst since 2001. But some aviation experts worry that after years of safety improvements, things may now be going backward. I have friends and family asking, should I get on an airplane? One retired controller told Axios. And I'm like, well, it's not there yet, but it seems to be trending that way. Moving into some of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. An anti-vax mandate for COVID. The people who hated mandates are now instituting one of their own, said Renee Graham. Food and Drug Administration officials, Drs. Vinay Prasad and Martin Makary, last week cast doubt on the need for additional COVID shots for most Americans, indicating the updated vaccine this fall will be available only to people over 65 and those with medical conditions. Prasad is a medical contrarian who publicly assailed vaccine policies even as the COVID pandemic ravaged communities. And Makary, a former Fox News talking head, baselessly called the government the greatest perpetrator of misinformation about the disease. Both work for Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime anti-vaxxer who announced COVID shots are no longer recommended for children or pregnant women, without providing any evidence for his decision. Now that these supposed libertarians have government power, they're restricting vaccine access even for people who want boosters. The more roadblocks they create, the less likely people are going to get one. COVID remains dangerous for infants, has left millions of people struggling with long COVID, and continues to mutate to elude immunity. Cutting off vaccines invites more infections, more sickness, and possibly more vaccine-resistant variants. That's not making America healthy again. A dire need for political moderates. Political moderates don't get much respect, said Matt Lewis. But in an age of extremism, the least sexy label might be the most essential temperament. For most of my life, I was considered very conservative, a Reagan Republican who believes in limited government, personal responsibility, and the right to be left the hell alone. My views haven't changed. But then Donald Trump took over the Republican Party, detonating every principle in a 50-mile radius. Suddenly, the balance of power shifted from a liberal cultural elite on the coast to the Trump right. Instead of a bastion of moral order that respected tradition and norms, conservatism came to sound like a rage-fueled Reddit thread. Rules, decency, and common sense were jettisoned as the MAGA mob purged heretics, idolized dear leader, and cheered on the chaos. Now I'm a man without a movement. Too conservative for the left, too sane for the right. Moderate is not a badge anyone wears proudly, but maybe it should be. Moderation might just be the last thing standing between us and the abyss. If that sounds grim, good. Extremist ideologues just may destroy our democracy. This is a How They See Us column from Europe. Has Trump finally seen through Putin? Vladimir Putin has been playing Donald Trump for a fool, said Mykola Chinotsky in Espresso from Ukraine. And it looks like the U.S. president might finally be catching on. Russia hit Ukraine this week with one of its most intense bombardments of the war, pounding Kyiv and other cities with hundreds of drones and missiles. In response, Trump expressed his outrage on social media, saying Putin had gone absolutely crazy and was needlessly killing a lot of people. Just days earlier, Trump had seemed to be going easy on Putin, abandoning his threat of sanctions after talking to him on the phone. It's encouraging if Trump now sees Putin for the madman he is. But what took him so long? A sane leader does not start a war, does not send hundreds of thousands of his citizens to die for no reason, and does not destroy his own country. The question now is whether Trump will respond to this latest barrage forcefully or effectively admit defeat to Putin. Don't expect Trump to get tough, said Sophia Dreisbach. One social media rant doesn't mean he has lost patience with Putin. For months now, Trump has been alternately admiring of Putin and exasperated by him. He boasted he would end the war on day one of his presidency, but 4 months on, he seems to have given up trying. His vacillating allows Putin to grab more Ukrainian territory to use as leverage in eventual peace talks. And even in the same post criticizing Putin, Trump couldn't resist taking a fresh swipe at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, saying, "Everything that comes out of his mouth causes problems." The reality is that only Putin can stop the war, said Irina Gerashenko in New Voice. The U.S. and the EU must try to create such hellish conditions that Putin realizes peace is his best option. To that end, Europe has proposed new sanctions on the shadow fleet of tankers Russia uses to distribute its oil to finance the war. And German Chancellor Friedrich Merz announced this week that the West, including the U.S., was lifting restrictions on Ukraine's use of Western-supplied long-range weapons. That will allow Kyiv to fire at targets deep inside Russia. As long as the U.S. stands firmly alongside Europe, it will show Putin that the era of Russia's impunity is over. Putin has already blinked, said Mikolaj Sushi in Kyiv Independent. This week's historic prisoner exchange, in which 1,000 Ukrainian prisoners of war were traded for 1,000 Russians, should prove to Trump that U.S. pressure on Russia makes a difference. Putin sees Ukrainian POWs as an asset, and his willingness to hand over so many of them could mean we've reached a tipping point. Don't bet on it, said Yigal Levin. As Danish military analyst Anders Nielsen points out, Putin sees this conflict as a defensive war. He is defending Russia's status as a great power. After the Baltic states joined NATO, he lost any chance of bringing them back into Russia's sphere of influence. No matter what it cost him, he won't let that happen to Ukraine. The Last Word, a feature article. Virtual currency, real world crimes. A $243 million heist started as a digital hack, said Mitch Moxley in the New York Times Magazine. It set off a chain of events that culminated in a terrifying kidnapping. In the balmy late afternoon of August 25th, 2024, Sushil and Radhika Cheadle were house hunting in Danbury, Connecticut, an upscale neighborhood of manicured yards and heated pools. Sushil, a vice president at Morgan Stanley in New York, was in the driver's seat of a new matte gray Lamborghini Urus, an SUV with a price tag starting around $240,000. As they turned a corner, the Lamborghini was suddenly rammed from behind by a white Honda Civic. At the same time, a white Ram ProMaster work van cut in front, trapping the Cheadles. According to a criminal complaint filed after the incident, a group of six men dressed in black and wearing masks emerged from their vehicles and forced the Cheadles from their car, dragging them toward the van's open side door. When Sushil resisted, the assailants hit him with a baseball bat and threatened to kill him. The men bound the couple's arms and legs with duct tape. They forced Radhika to lie face down and told her not to look at them, even as she struggled to breathe, pleading that she had asthma. Several witnesses saw the attack and called 911. Some of them, including an off-duty FBI agent who lived nearby and happened to be at the scene, trailed the van and the Honda, relaying the vehicle's movements to the police. Danbury police officers soon located the van. A patrol vehicle activated its emergency lights and tried to make a stop, but the driver of the van accelerated, swerving recklessly through traffic. About a mile from where the chase began, the driver careered off the road and struck a curb. Four suspects fled on foot. The police found one hiding under a bridge. Within a couple of hours, the other three were located in a wooded area nearby. The police, meanwhile, found the shaken Cheadles bound in the back of a van. Detective Sergeant Steve Krachevici of the Danbury Police Department had the day off when the shift commander called him at home about the incident. "We've got a kidnapping. A legit kidnapping," he remembers the shift commander telling him. Based on information provided by one of the suspects in custody, two more assailants were found and arrested the following morning at an Airbnb rental in Roxbury, a 30-minute drive from Danbury, where the white Civic was also parked. A few days after the attempted kidnapping, Krastavinci says his team received a tip from the FBI that cast the case in a strange new light. Possible connection to an enormous cryptocurrency heist, one that happened just a week before the attack. A group of young men, some of whom connected on a Minecraft server, were suspected of taking $250 million from an unwitting victim, setting off an incredible chain of events that involved an online network of cyber criminals, some of them teenagers, a group of independent digital detectives who tracked their efforts, and several law enforcement agencies. Now it seemed the whole thing had culminated in the kidnapping of the Cheetles, a real-world spillover from the brazen lawlessness of this expanding digital underworld and the culture that surrounds it. The chain of events began a couple of weeks earlier when a resident of Washington, D.C. began receiving suspicious sign-in notifications on his Google account. Then on August 18th, he received a phone call from someone claiming to be on Google's security team. The caller said the user's email account had been compromised. The call appeared to be legitimate. The caller knew the D.C. resident's personal information. The account holder, the caller said, would need to shut down his account unless he could verify certain personal information over the phone, which he did. Shortly after the call with the supposed Google agent, the same D.C. resident, whose identity remains concealed in federal court documents, received a second call from someone who said they were a security team representative from Gemini, a prominent cryptocurrency exchange. Like the supposed Google employee, he had the man's personal information. He explained that his Gemini account, which held about $4.5 million worth of coins, had been hacked, and that the man needed to reset his two-factor authentication and transfer the Bitcoin in his account to another wallet to keep it safe. The person on the phone then suggested that the account holder download a program that would provide additional security. The man agreed, not knowing that he was downloading a remote desktop app, which would give the caller access to his computer and access to a second crypto account, exposing him to even more staggering theft. It turned out that the D.C. resident, an early investor in cryptocurrency, had more than 4,100 Bitcoin in total, worth more than $243 million. Within minutes, it was all gone. A central paradox of crypto is that, although coin owners are generally not identifiable, transactions are recorded on a public ledger known as a blockchain. This means that when the currency moves, anyone can see it. This paradox has enabled a new class of sleuths who can identify suspicious transactions on the blockchain. One of the best of these detectives goes by the handle ZackXBT, an independent investigator of crypto-related crimes. Minute after the D.C. resident's funds were liquidated, ZackXBT was walking through the airport on his way to catch a flight when he received an alert on his phone about an unusual transaction. Crypto investigators use tools to monitor the global flows of various coins through certain exchanges that charge a premium for having few security safeguards. The initial alert that day was for a mid-six-figure transaction, followed by higher amounts, all the way up to $2 million. After he cleared airport security, ZackXBT sat down, opened his laptop, and began tracing transactions back to a Bitcoin wallet with roughly $240 million in crypto. Some of the Bitcoin in the wallet dated back to 2012. At that point, it didn't make sense, he told me. Why is a person who held their Bitcoin for this long using a sketchy service that typically sees a lot of illicit funds flow through it? On X, ZackXBT notified his followers about the heist in progress. 7 hours ago, a suspicious transfer was made from a potential victim for 4064 BTC, $238 million, he wrote. Funds were transferred to ThorChain, EXCH, KUCoin, Change Now, Railgun, and Avalanche Bridge, all crypto services. Zach XPT noticed that the victim had received bankruptcy payouts from Genesis, a lending platform, which filed for bankruptcy in 2023, related to the collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX. Using his network, he was eventually able to connect with the victim over email. The Shock DC resident hired Zach XBT and two crypto investigation firms to help track his stolen funds. That same day, he filed a police report with the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, and Zach XBT messaged his contacts in law enforcement. After Zach XBT's X post about the heist, a source reached out to him through a throwaway account with potential clues about the identities of the thieves. The source sent Zach XBT several screen share recordings, which he said were taken when one of the scammers live streamed the heist for a group of his friends. One clip featured the scammers' live reaction when they realized they'd successfully stolen $243 million worth of the DC residents' Bitcoin. A voice can be heard yelling, oh my God, $243 million. Yes, oh my God, bro. In private chats, they used screen names, but they made a crucial mistake. One of them flashed his Windows home screen, which revealed his real name in the start icon pop-up at the bottom of the screen. Veer Chital, an 18-year-old from Danbury, the son of the couple who were kidnapped. Classmates remember Cheeto as shy and a fan of cars. He just kind of kept to himself, said Marco Diaz, who became friends with Cheeto junior year. According to another classmate named Nick Paris, this was true of Cheeto until one day in the middle of his senior year when he showed up at school driving a Corvette. He just parked in the lot. It was 7:30 a.m. and everyone was like, what? Paris said. Soon Cheeto rolled up in a BMW, and then a Lamborghini Urus. Independent investigators say Cheeto was secretly a member of the COM, also referred to as the COM or the Community, an online network of chat groups that has its roots in the hacking underground of the 1980s and functions as a kind of social network for cyber criminals or aspiring ones. After Zach XBT had Veer Cheadle's name, it didn't take long for him and other investigators to figure out the identities of others involved in the crypto heist. In the recordings Zach XBT obtained, the thieves referred to one another by their COM aliases, but also, in some cases, by their real first names. One name frequently uttered was Malone. That was Malone Lamb, a known figure in the COM. Lamb was a 20-year-old from Singapore with a notorious Minecraft player with bangs roughly chopped at his eyeline. It was within Minecraft that Cheeto and Lamb first connected. In October 2023, Lamb arrived in the United States on a 90-day visa. After the August 2024 crypto heist, Zach XBT was able to track Lamb through social media. In comm chat groups, word was spreading that Lamb was on a wild spending spree. Nobody seemed to know the source of his money, but they spoke of his lavish exploits at Los Angeles nightclubs. On September 10th, after a 23-day party spree in Los Angeles, Lamb headed to Miami on a private jet with a group of friends. There, he rented multiple homes, including a 10-bedroom, $7.5 million estate. Every few days, Zach XBT sent the intelligence he'd collected to law enforcement. The information generally flowed one way, but federal authorities were conducting their own investigation simultaneously. They managed to connect the stolen Bitcoin to an IP address that was registered to a $47,500 per month rental home in Encino, California. It was leased to Gendiel Serrano, 21, who went by Versace God at Skidstar. and Box Online. By the time the authorities identified Serrano, he was on vacation in the Maldives with his girlfriend. On September 18th, Serrano flew back from the Maldives to Los Angeles International Airport, where the authorities were waiting for him. He was wearing a $500,000 watch at the time of his arrest. Serrano initially denied knowledge of the theft and agreed to speak with law enforcement without a lawyer, but he soon acknowledged his involvement, according to court reports, specifically to impersonating a Gemini employee. Later that day, a team of FBI agents working with the Miami police raided a mansion near Miami Shores. Agents blew open the front metal gate while another group entered by boat via a small saltwater canal in the rear. Moments later, an agent escorted a handcuffed Lamb, who wore a long-sleeve white top, maroon basketball shorts, and sneakers, as smoke hung in the air, followed by at least five other people who were in the house with him. Serrano and Lamb were charged with money laundering and conspiracy to commit wire fraud. They face up to 20 years in prison for each charge. In Danbury, in the days and weeks after the kidnapping of the Cheadles, Castrovinci and the police worked with federal investigators to build cases against the group in Florida. The men, the police believed, had targeted the Cheadles to hold them for ransom for the money their son had. Independent investigators think that at least one member of the group, Rinaldo Ray Diaz, who they say went by the alias Pantic, was a member of the COM. The six Florida men reflect a growing faction of the COM, less interested in online schemes and more concerned with using brute force. Diaz was himself shot in Florida 2 years earlier when he was the target of a robbery attempt. This year, five of the six Florida men pleaded guilty to federal kidnapping and conspiracy charges. They could face 15 years in prison. On March 25th, Zach XBT posted a new message to his original thread on the X, chronicling his investigation into the stolen crypto. Update: Wiz, Veer Cheadle, was arrested, he wrote. According to Zach XBT, the stolen Bitcoin he traced to addresses belonging to Cheadle is now in a wallet controlled by law enforcement. The matte gray Lamborghini Urus, the one that Sushil and Radhika Cheadle were driving the day of the kidnapping, is still sitting as evidence in a secure police lot in Danbury. It's the same Lamborghini their son once drove to school. A version of this story was first published in the New York Times Magazine. Got one of the obituaries for you. The everyman actor who was Norm on Cheers, George Wendt, 1948 to 2025. When George Wendt's agent sent him to an audition for a new sitcom set in a Boston bar, she warned him the part was small. He was to speak just one word: beer. But the producers of Cheers saw something in the portly actor with the regular Joe air, and they hatched another plan. Wendt was cast as a fan favorite, Norm Peterson, the beer-quaffing barfly who was glued to a bar stool in every one of the Smash Show's 275 episodes, from 1982 to 1993. An underemployed accountant, the stoic Norm dodged his wife, bantered with regular Cliff Clavin, and with unerring comic timing, dropped deadpan one-liners on barkeeps Sam and Woody. How's a beer sound? I don't know. I usually finish them before they get a word in. Wendt, who received six Emmy nominations, allowed that playing an average guy who loves cold ones didn't exactly require heroic shape-shifting for him. Norm is just me with better writing, he said in 2021. One of nine children, Wendt grew up in Chicago, where his father ran a real estate agency, said the Washington Post. After Jesuit prep school, he attended Notre Dame, where he was invited to leave because of hard partying, lack of focus, and poor grades. He fared better at Rockhurst College, earning an economics degree. But a straight job held little interest, and with virtually no experience, he decided to pursue acting. Returning to Chicago, he did years of training at workshops run by the storied Second City Comedy Troupe, before finally joining both the resident and touring companies. In 1980, he moved to Hollywood, finding favor with his easy charm and lunch-pail demeanor, said the New York Times. He appeared on shows such as Taxi and Alice before attending the fateful Cheers audition. After Cheers, Wendt landed his own sitcom, said the Times, The George Wendt Show, in which he played a mechanic, bombed and was canceled after a few episodes. Still, in later years, he was rarely out of work. He appeared in numerous films on Broadway, in Elf and Hairspray, and on TV series such as Portlandia and Seinfeld. Over the years, he reprised Norm on shows like The Simpsons and the Cheers spinoff Frasier. He co-wrote a 2009 book, Drinking with George, that was part memoir, part love letter to his favorite beverage. Will Rogers once said he never met a man he didn't like, he wrote. I feel the same about beer. And we've got time for one of the Talking Points articles. National debt. Why Congress no longer cares. Now would be a very good time for Washington to bring back its debt obsession, said Roj Karma in The Atlantic. That's because the perfect storm for turning the federal deficit into a genuine crisis has arrived. In recent years, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates dramatically in an effort to tame inflation. Since that means the federal government has to pay a higher interest on its bonds, government payments on debt interest soared to $881 million in 2024. That's more than the U.S. spent last year on national defense. At the same time, President Trump's tariff policies have led almost every credible forecast this year to anticipate slowed economic growth. Then there's Trump's big, beautiful, and bloated budget bill, which would add more than $3 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. The warning signals are flashing red, and if Washington continues to ignore them, very bad things can happen. From 1970s-style stagflation to a panicked flight from U.S. treasuries and a global financial meltdown. So far, bond markets are showing concern but not panic, said Victoria Guida in Politico. The credit rating firm Moody's slightly downgraded the safety of U.S. bonds, and investor unease pushed interest rates on those bonds above 5%. Still, if Congress doesn't heed these warnings and shift the trajectory of the budget bill, which would add trillions of dollars in tax cuts without also making politically painful spending cuts, something more painful than a mild Moody's downgrade could occur. Don't bet on lawmakers acting responsibly, said Clive Cook in Bloomberg. The 2008 bank bailouts and COVID-related spending under both Democrats and Republicans ballooned the national debt to previously unimaginable levels. It's now $36.2 trillion. Rather than confront debt of that magnitude, all but a few remaining deficit hawks just stopped thinking about it. Facing it would mean huge spending cuts and major tax increases, both of which are very unpopular. Instead, Republicans are now trying to hide the bill's unfathomable costs from voters, said Jessica Rydell in MSNBC.com. But it's the voters who will suffer as a result. The rapidly growing debt and massive interest payments create economic drag, diverting wealth away from the investments that would start businesses, create jobs, and raise incomes. As Washington continues to take an ostrich-like approach to the national debt, something large and unpleasant is bearing down on all of us. And we can get a couple of the short notes. The U.S. military has spent $6 billion since 2022 trying to recruit and retain soldiers and personnel. Recruitment dropped off sharply during the pandemic because lockdowns prevented the job fairs and school visits that recruiters rely on. While the Navy spent the most by far, it was the sole branch that failed to reach its targets last year. At least 50 of the 238 Venezuelan men sent by the Trump administration to El Salvador's infamous CICAT prison had entered the U.S. legally as vetted arrivals, according to the Cato Institute. That number could be much higher, as the analysis looked at only 90 migrants whose method of entry could be determined. Child care costs in the U.S. rose 29% from 2020 to 2024, according to the advocacy group Child Care Aware, outpacing the 21.2% overall rate of inflation during that period. The average annual cost of daycare tuition nationwide for a family with a toddler and an infant was about $28,000 last year, or 35% of the median household income. And we'll finish today with a quote from Mother Teresa, who says, "Love is not patronizing, and charity isn't about pity. It is about love." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.